There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abuhul, Annabelle Corton, and the rest of the team, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello and welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle Corton, with me in the studio David McAdam and our lovely castaway guest who's stranded on a desert island, Rachel Hamilton.
Hello.
Hey. So we've had Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman so far as book one. Book two, we've had The Secret Diary of Adrienne Mole, aged 13 and three quarters, can't forget that, by Sue Townsend. Now your third book that you're taking to a desert island for a very long time surprised me.
Well, so you'd expect me to now come up with my really long book, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
so
you're
I was
Dickens.
Thinking Great Expectations. Yeah. But then I changed my mind. And this is partly because I thought, I've seen the movies. Everybody who gets stranded on a desert island eventually meets the savages. And I thought, I want to be able to communicate with the savages, so better to take a simple book with simple language and we can bond over my picture book. So I decided I'd take my all-time favourite picture book, which is Not Now, Bernard, by David McKee.
Have you read this, David?
And that's another one I have.
It's absolutely terrifying.
It's fabulous. It's another one. It's a bit like Coraline. Lots of adults think that this is a terrible, scary book and it will utterly traumatise their children. Kids love it. I loved it when I was told it when I was small. I was a little bit bigger than small, to be honest, but I loved it. And my kids loved it when I read it to them. Jodie was slightly more frightened, but my son absolutely adored it. And if you like, because it's only 154 words long, I could read the story.
Go for it.
So basically, this is the story about poor Bernard, who has a problem because he's found a monster in the back garden. But his mum and dad are just too busy to pay any attention. So Bernard tries to make friends with the monster, only it doesn't go quite to plan.
Oh.
So here we go. "Hello, Dad," said Bernard. "Ugh, not now, Bernard," said his father. "Hello, Mum," said Bernard. "Not now, Bernard," said his mother. "There's a monster in the garden and it's going to eat me," said Bernard. "Not now, Bernard," said his mother. Bernard went into the garden. "Hello, monster," he said to the monster. The monster ate Bernard up, every bit. And then the monster went indoors. "Rawr!" went the monster behind Bernard's mother. "Not now, Bernard," said Bernard's mother. The monster bit Bernard's father. "Ow! Not now, Bernard," said Bernard's father. "Your dinner's ready," said Bernard's mother. She put the dinner in front of the television. The monster ate the dinner. Then it watched the television. Then it read one of Bernard's comics and broke one of Bernard's toys. "Go to bed, I've taken up your milk," called Bernard's mother. The monster went upstairs.
"But I'm a monster," said the monster.
"Not now, Bernard," said Bernard's mother.
Love it.
How can you not love that book? It's brilliant.
I kept turning the pages because I only
waiting
read...
for the happy ending.
I did. I know, because I read this a couple of days ago and I'm thinking, okay, this is the book Rachel wants to do. Lovely picture book going through. Where's the bit where he spits Bernard back out? Where's that page? It's not there. What's going on?
But I've had amazing discussions about this book and about what it really means and whether there's metaphors behind it and whether actually Bernard becomes the monster as the result of being ignored. And it's fascinating, different ways to think about the book.
It's funny you should mention that because honestly, some of the most exciting, you know, metaphysical discussions I've had about
over
literature have been over picture books.
No, they really are. They're brilliant. There's so much thought goes into them. And also this book, if anyone wants to buy it, which I highly recommend, and kids will love it, I promise, there's an amazing kind of byplay between the words and the pictures, like you have in all the best picture books. So you see on the first, it's very colourful. It's all kind of pinks and oranges and beautiful. And on the first book, you see Bernard looking very happy as he approaches his father. And then as his father does the whole "not now, Bernard," you don't see a massive drop in Bernard's expression. You just see little changes, like his hands go in his pockets. And so you realise that this is probably something Bernard's used to. And then it's beautifully done because Bernard is kind of lit up on that first page when he's happy, and then the light moves away from Bernard as he gets ignored, and it's really sweetly done. And then the reason that people say perhaps it's metaphorical and Bernard becomes a monster is because the eyes that are drawn on Bernard are virtually identical to the eyes that are drawn on the monster.
I never noticed that.
It's interesting. There's a lot of depth to "Not Now, Bernard," that you might not see.
I would
see
say subtlety as well, by
yeah.
So have you found your new evening read, David?
Well, I'm really quite enjoying The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole now. Yes. I've just been thumbing through it.
He's actually not doing any co-hosting right now. He's just reading
just
books.
Reading.
Well, that is part of the co-host job, I thought.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I don't know if this is correct, but when I was teaching, I took a few picture books in to show my teenage group that I was teaching to show how words and pictures can work together. And one of them made a really interesting observation, and I don't know if it's correct, but they said that in the bits leading up to the monster, where people are ignoring him, the colours become a bit kind of cacophonous and chaotic, and they make you turn the page quicker, therefore making you also ignore Bernard. And I don't know if that's correct, but I thought, what an interest. See, teenagers come up with the best kind of explanations of things. And then as soon as you get into the garden with the monster, the pictures are more rounded and calmer and less colours. And so maybe then you're calming down a bit with the monster rather than that should be the crazy page.
Rachel, can we start a grown-ups picture book reading group?
We should. I've got several. Like Where the Wild Things Are, another brilliant one.
We were talking about that a couple of weeks ago, actually.
It's fantastic. That would have been another of my desert island books.
So you think that taking this to a desert island would be a good idea and that it wouldn't inspire any savages that you came across to, say, eat you?
Not me, no. They can go and eat Bernard.
They can go and eat Bernard. Okay. So we've had Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman, The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole by Sue Townsend, and Not Now, Bernard by David McKee.
Yes.
Any advances on that? Because this is for a very long time.
Well, obviously, I nearly bought The Great Expectations.
Yeah.
I did think about it. And I do find... This is the thing. Although I've picked kind of kids' books, being an underdeveloped adult, and funny books, it's not that I don't enjoy literature, but I think that sometimes when you're going to be somewhere for a long time and you want something to return to and something to lift your spirits, sometimes the more, I don't know, comic, childlike, simple books are often the ones that I would pick.
And would keep you sane.
Exactly. And it's not that they're easier to read, because I love read. I mean, I've been an English teacher, I've done English degrees, you know, I enjoy all the kind of more high level, as people call them, books. But I return time and time again to brilliantly written kids books or Neil Gaiman's kind of underdeveloped adult books, however you put it. Just think they're brilliant.
Are you somebody who tends to reread books?
Yes, very, very much so. I can't tell you how many times I've read The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole. That copy looks quite clean because I rebought it because the others fell apart. I think I've owned about 10 versions of that book,
so
over time.
Embarrassed to bring your real copy.
A little bit, yes. And I do throw them away. But when they get a bit old and falling apart, I should probably save them.
What's the one that you're most excited about reading, David?
Well, there's a number of different books. The one that I've read recently...
He's reaching across the room to grab it.
Yes, I have to find it. So I'm holding it so I can explain to everyone exactly what it is. But I quite enjoyed it. It's by Dr. Michio Kaku. And it's The Physics of the Future, The Inventions That Will Transform Our Lives. And the interesting part about this book, which I just read a month ago or thereabouts, is that it was written in 2011. And when I read about what's going on in the world now, like we'll get into in our book called Woolly, a lot of the things that he discusses in 2011 have already come to pass in 2017. So it's a very fast-paced, high-change-style world in the world of sciences. And I think that's what I am really been drawn to with this particular book, that there's so much in science that is growing so quickly that I had no idea that was actually taking place. So the book by Dr. Michio Kaku, The Physics of the Future, written in 2011, he took a year and interviewed 300 of the top scientists in their field. And he's a brilliant man by himself, so he was able to understand the leading edge work that these scientists were doing, and then highlighted them, what they were doing in the book. And I found it incredibly interesting that the world has evolved as far and as fast as it has, and I'm sitting back in some little bubble somewhere out of touch.
So does this book unfold as a series of basically each interview in turn, or is everything kind of a reflection on those 300 interviews?
Everything turns around the 300 interviews, okay. But for example, when he gets into biotech or when he gets into gene splicing or other elements like that, he will talk to several different scientists, leading scientists in those fields, and then summarize where they're at and what's going on and what these other people see as the future of that science. And I found it incredibly, incredibly insightful.
Remind us of the title and the author.
It's called The Physics of the Future. It's written by Dr. Michio Kaku, M-I-C-H-I-O-K-A-K-U.
So there you go. That's David's recommendation.
Sounds good.
I think all I will be fit for this evening there is Not Now, Bernard.
I recommend it.
Although I do find it very scary still. I think it's interesting that kids don't.
I didn't as a child. And do you know what I found? I almost found it reassuring as a child, because when I read it, I got the impression that it was sort of all right to be a monster. Aww. Because I don't know. I think a lot of children have reasonably dark thoughts or do things that are a little bit naughty, that in their head are much more awful than they realise. And I know a lot of parents go, where did my lovely Annabelle go? Who is this monster that's here instead?
You've been listening in
your house. to your mother. No, I haven't. But I've done it before. Where's my lovely Jodie? Who is this? And then you create this idea in kids that their bad behaviour is somehow disassociated. Whereas I've read this and I thought, monsters are all right. They get to watch telly. They get bought their milk in bed. It's okay to be a monster sometimes and still be loved.
That's the bit I liked about the book, actually, was the fact that the monster at the end of the book, if you look at that final illustration where he's all tucked up in bed, he goes, but I'm a monster. What am I doing here?
And it's almost like, if nobody believes you're a monster, are you still a monster? So that's another kind of a way of looking at it. Is that how you cure the monstrous people, by just pretending they're not monstrous?
Or are we all monsters in some way every day?
I think we all are.
And at the end of the day, when you tuck yourself into bed or are tucked into bed, you can be someone else.
Nice. And you wake up the next day yourself again.
Starting all over fresh.
I like it.
This reminds me of a series that was very, very popular, but not a lot of teachers and parents like, and that's Goosebumps.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, and I remember reading one story that I shouldn't have read, because I absolutely did not cope with scary stories. But obviously I was tempted by the school library. And I remember reading one where you went through the entire book identifying with the main character and assuming that they were just like you. And at the end of the book, you realised that the monster in the cupboard was actually a human being.
Nice.
And that you'd been reading the story entirely from the perspective of, say, aliens or monsters.
Darren Shan did something very similar in one of his books that I don't know if I should mention because it is a big spoiler, but he did that very masterfully. It was very clever. I liked it.
You can mention the spoiler.
Can I? It's in his zombie books. And what you don't realise is the narrator is actually a zombie. And you don't realise that until... And also, you don't realise the gender as well. It's all a bit smartly done.
Oh, I love stuff like that. So you're all set for your desert island.
I'm all set for my desert island.
We have had a couple of text messages come in, and they've come in quite delayed. So we have a few Roald Dahl things, but they are quite lovely. So Alexis has said, 6 of Roald Dahl's splendiferous words have been added to the Oxford English Dictionary. Darlesque, golden ticket, human bean, Oompa Loompa, scrumdiddlyumptious, and witching hour. And a few other words have revised definitions as a result of Mr. Dahl. And I'd like to recommend the Roald Dahl Dictionary for anybody who wants
brilliant.
It. It's absolutely wonderful.
By OUP.
Loveliest
Oxford
publisher
University. Ever.
Not that you're biased or anything at all,
just,
are you?
No, just mentioning.
And your books, Rachel. Please share your books.
I have 2 series. One with the wonderful OUP, which is Louis the Unicorn's Adventures, Unicorn in New York. And there are 4 of those in that series. And then the Exploding series with the Exploding Lou and the Exploding Brains.
I never asked you this, but why does Louis go to New York?
Well, it was one of those ones. It was partly help from kids that I visited on school visits. And we used to make up stories, and it was all about where people went and what they wanted to do. And people liked the idea of this fame seeking idea, and they like the unicorn, and I always wanted to live in New York, so I thought I shall stick him there.
More when we come back. Thank you so much, Rachel, for telling us what you take to a desert island. Stay with us.
From Agatha Christie to Jeffrey Archer, we've got it covered. Talking of books, here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff about...
Welcome back to Talking of Books, and if you've just tuned in, you're in time for our Arab World topic of the day to lift off. But first, I want to introduce our star guest for the day, who's sitting very patiently in the corner. So I'm going to build him up a little bit. He likes chocolate banana pudding, he likes Roald Dahl, he writes for Khalij Times, and his fantastic blog, Man of the Hour. Man Jalal, welcome to Talking of Books.
Hey guys, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
So do you like chocolate banana pudding? I got that off your YouTube videos.
Yeah, I'm obsessed, pretty much obsessed.
Okay. So you're back again. You've been on Talking of Books before.
Yep.
What are you talking about today?
Today I'm talking about a poet who most people know of but may not have read. He is the best-selling poet in the US, which people find surprising, and his name is Jalal al-Din Rumi, or he's more commonly known as Rumi. So he is a Middle Eastern poet who is quite well known.
Yeah. So I know the basics. Like you say, a lot of people know that he's, you know, best-selling poet. So if you look up quotes or inspirational poetry, he always comes up. He's always there on top of Google search. So I know that he's a 13th century Persian Sunni Muslim poet, jurist, Islamic scholar, theologian, and Sufi mystic. So that's basically the main bio information that comes up when you look for him. So what are we missing?
What you're missing is the, I guess, the journey of how Rumi became so universal and well-known. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting story that not many people know. Now, he comes from a line of scholars. His father was a very well-known scholar, so was his grandfather. And for the first 37 years of Rumi's life, he was a Muslim scholar, and he was very, very well-known. And he had a massive following. He was married with two children, and he had an adoptive daughter as well. But when he turned 37, his whole life changed when he met a person called Shams al-Tabriz. Now, not many people know of or who Shams al-Tabriz is, but Shams was a mystic dervish. So I'm sure you guys have heard of these swirling dervish dancers. Yeah, the whirling dervish. So that practice is a kind of a meditation that combines dance and music. And Shams was kind of, was one of those people, and he was not interested in the material world. He was more interested in the spiritual world. And it's said that he got a type of vision, that he had to meet Rumi in order to enlighten him and to meet his equal. And so he met Rumi when Rumi was 37, and they developed an incredibly intense intellectual and spiritual friendship, which... They discussed religion, they discussed love, they discussed poetry and linguistics and different languages. And because of this friendship, Rumi ended up, I suppose you could say, neglecting his scholarly duties, his duties to his followers and his family. But because I guess you could say he was learning, or he was being more enlightened, and everything he thought he understood about himself and about spirituality changed completely. So I think after about 2 years of them developing this friendship, Shams suddenly just disappeared. Nobody knows if he just left. He had done his job, quote-unquote, to enlighten Rumi and disappeared. And some people believe he was actually murdered, either by...
Yeah, I was reading about that.
Either by Rumi's disciples, who were very jealous of the friendship and felt that Rumi was changing because he was neglecting his responsibilities. And some people even believe that Rumi's eldest son ordered for Shams's his murder. So it's quite intense if you really think about it. And Rumi went on to look for Shams. He went to Syria and he searched for him in all the places he thought he would be, but he never found him.
Because that separation was quite hard on Rumi, wasn't
Incredibly
it?
Incredibly hard, because it was the first time that he'd met somebody who was of equal, I suppose you would say, intellectual level, but he could also learn from. So for somebody so intelligent, that intellectual friendship meant everything to him. So after Shams's disappearance, that's when Rumi began to write his poetry. He wrote poems about heartbreak and love and joy and peace, and 3,000 poems dedicated to Shams and to God and to the Prophet Muhammad as well. He also wrote the three-book epic poem, The Misnavi, which has sold in the millions since then.
So even though it was quite a stressful time for him and he had to cope by writing all this poetry, in a way, for whatever reason he disappeared, whether it was simple disappearance or murder or whatever, we should be kind of grateful.
Yeah.
Because it meant that we have the poetry that we have today. Well, that feels a little selfish.
Exactly. And it's interesting because a lot of people are asking, like, why is Rumi still relevant today, 800 years on? Like, why is this so interesting, especially given the fact that he was, you know, he's writing about something, I suppose, quite specific. And I came across Rumi when I was 16. I was in the library in New Zealand where I was living at the time, and I was just looking for something to read, and I came across this tattered old book of Rumi's poetry. And the way Rumi's poetry works is that they're very short, I guess you would say quatrains or stanzas or short lines, and the language is very simple. It's not complicated imagery like you would have, I guess you'd say, with Walt Whitman or Emily Dickinson or Alice Walker or Maya Angelou, who were the other poets I was reading at the time. So this was very simple writing. Even though the ideas are quite complicated, the imagery was simple, and I think anybody from any culture or age or walk of life can really relate to it instantly.
So it's accessible.
It's accessible.
And timeless, I would think.
Exactly. It's timeless as well. It's a really great word to use with Rumi. It's because I think other poets and writers date, not because the times change, but because their ideas are fundamentally inaccurate or wrong. But Rumi's ideas aren't wrong because he writes about human nature, and all of us, you know, have heartbreak and love and loss. And so until people stop feeling those things, that's when Rumi's poetry, I think, will be redundant. And because his writing isn't dated, it makes sense for anyone to read them.
I mean, what you've just said now has reminded me of somebody else who's well-known and timeless across the globe, across different cultures. I mean, there's a great quote from somebody called Lee Brichetti, who's the executive director of Poets House, and she said about Rumi, "Across time, place, and culture, Rumi's poems articulate what it feels like to be alive, and they help us understand our own search for love and the ecstatic in the coil of daily life." And I think that last line, "the coil of daily life," immediately makes me think of Shakespeare.
Yeah. And even though I don't like to make those comparisons, but he is technically, you could say, the Shakespeare of the Middle East. He has the same, you know, timeless
enduring
effect.
Appeal.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wonder if you could elaborate on how else Rumi has permeated pop culture. Mm-hmm. And we have a little clip to maybe jog your memory. What am I talking about?
Isn't that Beyoncé, Single Ladies?
Yeah.
One of the most popular songs.
So what does this have to do with Rumi?
So this has, funnily enough, a lot to do with Rumi. As you guys know, Beyoncé, and the whole world knows, just had twins, I think, 3 months ago.
I have no idea.
Sometime soon. The whole world stopped when she had her kids. So she called, I think she called her son Sir. I mean, we all know celebrities love to name their kids odd names,
yes,
right?
Yes, she did.
So, but she called her daughter Rumi. And when I first heard this, I thought it was so bizarre to call your daughter Rumi. I mean, everybody has license to call their kid whatever they want. But in essence, Rumi's name, it's actually his surname. So it's Jalal al-Din Rumi. And Rumi means man from Rome or man from Europe. Because at the time, in the part of Turkey that Rumi lived in was considered a part of Rome. And so I thought it was really funny and odd that Jay-Z and Beyoncé, who are, you know, iconic African-American musicians and rappers, and, you know, they're incredibly iconic and looked up to, that they would name their daughter a name that technically means man of Europe. I just thought it was really bizarre and odd, and I thought maybe they didn't really think about what that name actually meant.
Maybe they just thought it sounded nice.
I'm sure that was probably what it was.
Yeah, which is a little bit of a shame, because you sort of, I think, need to think about these names sometimes.
I wonder, who would you recommend Rumi for? Like how would you recommend him? Would you recommend a particular poem for somebody? I mean, if they've not, I've not actually read that much.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you begin?
There are so many books about Rumi, and a couple I would recommend. The first one I would recommend is just go to any bookstore and pick up any of Rumi's poetry. There's one great book called The Essential Rumi, and it has a lot of very short poems by Rumi, which I think is great. If you're interested to read about Rumi from a... If you're interested in his life, I would recommend that you read The 40 Rules of Love by Elif Shafak, the Turkish writer.
And I have read that. That's fabulous.
You've read that?
Yes. And I've totally enjoyed the whole thing.
It's great because it really gives you a contemporary perspective from one of the characters and how they see Rumi, as well as giving you chapters on Rumi's life and his meeting with Shams al-Tabriz and what happened there.
And the meaning of love and how it goes through cycles and all different things.
Exactly. Like that, yeah. Another great book as well I would recommend is Rumi's Daughter by Meryl Malouf, I think her name is. And it is about Rumi's adoptive daughter who, in fact, married Shams al-Tabriz for a very short period of time, and it goes through their life and their very tumultuous relationship. And you have a book as well, don't you?
Well, there's a couple of books that I brought in because I'm a huge Rumi fan, always have been, and one of them is called The Whispers of the Beloved, which I quite enjoy. I love it. The other part about, the other one that I brought along today is the Rumi Day Book, 365 Poems and Teachings by, it's called From the Beloved Sufi Master, which I've really enjoyed, by Kabir and Kamil Helminski, which is the author of the book. And then there's another one that I brought along too called The Soul of Rumi, which is another great book. And all of these are basically a collection of the all of the greatest poems that he has. I have one of the favorite sayings of his, and this is what Rumi meant to me and means to me. Yes, and I'll quote it from Rumi. Yesterday I was clever, so I wanted to change the world. Today I am wise, so I am changing myself. That's by Rumi.
That is one of my favorite Rumi lines, and I read that when I was 16, and it reminded me of Michael Jackson, as funnily as that sounds, to talk about pop culture again, because Michael Jackson's song, Man in the Mirror,
yes.
If you want to change the world, you know, change the man in the mirror, and it rings true throughout time. So that's one of my favorite quotes by Rumi. One of his great poems as well is called Like This. There is a wonderful rendition by Tilda Swinton, the actor. If you just go on YouTube, I just saw your face light up when I said Tilda Swinton.
Sorry, I love Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, she's amazing. So she's a big Rumi fan. So she did a reading of his poem Like This. Just Google it on YouTube. It's brilliant. Other artists that like or have been influenced by Rumi, people might find surprising, are Madonna. Chris Martin wrote about how when him and Gwyneth Paltrow split, Rumi's poem, The Guest House, really helped him to make sense of his split from Gwyneth Paltrow.
So we have Rumi to thank for that conscious uncoupling as well.
Yes, conscious uncoupling. That is the buzzword.
Well, I think that Rumi also helps you to understand that it has happened before, and you're not the first, and that he's suffered that way somehow as well.
800 years ago.
Yeah, that's why it's timeless. Yeah.
I find it incredible that it endures. I mean, yes, Shakespeare and all these wonderful, you know, poets and playwrights. I just find it incredible that we still find what makes us human in what they wrote today, and in a time of Facebook and Beyonce and Twitter, and we still understand what they were trying to say, and it's still relevant.
And funnily enough, Rumi's poetry has made it on Twitter and Instagram. There's a Twitter handle that's completely dedicated to Rumi. It's called Rumi's Secrets. And every day, whoever the user is, posts a Rumi quote. So it's a great way to just start your day. Yeah.
Yeah, so thank you very much to Manjalal. We're going to call you Chocolate
Thank you,
Banana Mom. Lover and Rumi Expert.
Yes. <Yeah. laughs>
In the studio. When we come back, what are we doing, David?
That's a good question. We've talked about so many things today, but I think that we'll come back and we'll get into some of the biggest questions that you ever wanted to know about.
Quite literally, we're talking about woolly mammoths. Stay tuned.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Daniel Steele, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle Corson. With me in the studio, David McAdam, and our lovely guest back again, because she won't go away.
Can't get rid of me.
Can't get rid of
me. I will come back.
Rachel Hamilton. And it's time for my personal favourite, the big question, which is literary questions you've always wanted to know the answer to, but not until I told you that you did.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. It's David McAdam here with Annabelle Corton. And we have, thankfully, Rachel Hamilton back with us as well. It's wonderful. Today, we're going to be talking about one of the books that I think is, I think, one of the favorite books that I have read in a long time, called Wooly. And it says, soon to be a major motion picture. And it's written by Ben Mezrich. I think that when you get into the book, first of all, Rachel was saying, when she saw it, she didn't really know whether she wanted to read it.
Yeah. And why? I was being very truthful. Well, I was saying that my Castaway books were obviously my favourite books ever.
Yeah.
And then for the show, I also had to read Woolly Mammoth. So that was probably the one I was least looking forward to reading. But actually, as I got into it, it's been my favourite one, I think, in many ways.
So you enjoyed your homework.
I loved my homework.
I must try harder next time.
Yeah,
give you something
awful.
Absolutely
fascinating. I was saying to someone, it's the most fun I've had learning about science since the days of like Mento and Coca-Cola when it made exploding volcano. It's brilliant.
So this is the big question. So how does this fit in? I've devised a big question that none of you seem to know the answer to. What do Facebook and the woolly mammoth have in common?
They're very big.
Very big. Any advances
big
on
and
that?
Hairy.
Big and hairy.
Big and hairy. No. The answer is the author, Ben Mezrich. And I'm not sure if it's Mezrich
network,
or Mezrich.
Of course, yes. Yeah. Mezrich, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yes.
So he wrote the book that became The Social Network.
Yes,
and he's also written
that.
this book, which is about bringing back the woolly mammoth. Now, before we start talking about this in depth, I want to give you an idea of what this book is about. Okay, so Jurassic Park, science fiction, yes, but with a credible idea behind it, right? So what if you could use science and DNA to resurrect extinct creatures that once roamed the Earth? And they're actually doing this, aren't they, with a woolly mammoth?
Yes, but they don't eat people.
But they don't. So less dangerous, everybody. Yes. No need to panic. No need to panic. So did you enjoy reading about this?
I absolutely loved reading it. And also, it's so well done by Ben Mezrich. He has a brilliant way of making fact into fiction, to the point where I kept having to Google to find out if the people that he mentioned were really like genuine people. And they always were. And yet he managed to turn it into a really compelling story rather than a sort of description of scientific discoveries, which are also covered, but in an absolutely fascinating way.
So the heart of this project is basically to get an Asian elephant, isn't it?
Yes, because they're more friendly than African elephants.
Really?
Yes, that was the reason given.
Whole idea. Yeah? They don't attack and kill you.
Yes.
Oh, right. Okay, lovely. So then that's going to give birth to a woolly mammoth, hopefully.
Yes.
When is this going to happen?
Well, in here, he's guessing. Was it 2020 or something? I've forgotten what date.
No,
just in time for the expo.
Oh, 2035. Sorry, there's me getting really overexcited. 2035. Yeah.
And the reason for that is because the gestation period for an Asian elephant to deliver is around 22 months. So when you think about creating a herd, that's going to take some time.
Wow. That's going to take
a long time. No, hang on. It says 4 years from today.
And when was it was published this year?
Yeah.
Published 2017.
2021. I read 2035 in it somewhere. Only because it took quite a while to get all of the science right, because all of the science isn't quite in place yet.
Yeah, no, here, the bit that I was thinking about is it says that in 4 years from today, and again, this is the fictionalized bit, but about how he was going to take another step forward when he saw something in the distance moving towards them, large, lumbering, and vaguely familiar, and it seemed to get bigger, and then it talks about, you know, something that shouldn't have existed, hadn't existed for more than 3,000 years. It wasn't possible, but it was inevitable. I love it.
I think you're absolutely right about the way he's written this, because the opening is from the point of view of the woolly mammoth.
Yes.
And what's also incredible is that the particular area, the island, I can't remember the name of the
island.
Wangaroo Island. They were still surviving there, a herd of woolly mammoths, when all the rest of their species had died off in the rest of the world.
I was also interested to hear that they were killed off by humans rather
than... They were eaten,
yes. Yeah. Because I just assumed it was an ice age thing or, you know, climate change thing. But actually what it said is that the thing that really killed them was us.
I think it's kind of, you know, fair that we bring them back.
And then they can eat us.
But why are we trying to do this in the first place?
Because we can. No, actually it was the global warming challenge, wasn't it? So basically what they realised is that we think greenhouse greenhouse gases are the big threat, but actually permafrost is the big threat. So as the Arctic cap melts, it releases the bubbles of methane gas that are trapped beneath it, and that and CO2 enter the environment at an even greater pace than we've managed with, you know, humankind's mistakes and aerosols, what have you. And then that will cause much bigger global warming issues. So what they're saying is if they can reinvent the landscape of thousands of years ago with animals kind of pressing down and creating pastures and squashing snow and making it less likely to be kind of insulating the earth and make it colder, then if it's colder, we won't release these gases and therefore global warming will slow down.
That's an even better than Ben Meserick gives here. he answers this question, but you've actually done it in more depth and detail. But we're going to listen to him anyway.
I think he probably knows more than I do, so let's listen to him.
The
permafrost, which is this frozen tundra that's like the ring of the world, it's a ticking time bomb. It contains within it more carbon than if we burned all the forests on Earth three times.
Wow.
And these Russian scientists, the Zimovs, have shown since the 80s that if you repopulate it with herbivores from the Pleistocene era, and they're using tanks to mimic woolly mammoths and they're putting bison there, they've managed to lower the temperature of the tundra by 15 degrees. So the goal is to put a herd of woolly mammoths in the Siberian tundra to keep the permafrost from melting.
So there you go. And if you'd like to win a copy of Woolly, by the way, by Ben Meserick, you need to text in the name of the extinct creature that they're trying to revive in this book to 4001 and your name. Okay? There we go. So on with the book. What else would you like to... What else was your favourite part about reading this?
I just thought it was so beautifully written because I was interested in the fact that it almost showed how a scientist is created from childhood. So you had a lot of stories about George Church's childhood and about how normal everyday kids things were what inspired him. And so you saw that he would go out and he would find, he once found an insect graveyard where there were kind of the cocoons and things left behind. And I think he was about five at the time, and he would go home, get out the family encyclopedia because he needed to know why they were there, how they got there, why these creatures had left bits of themselves behind. Or it told the story of how there was his mum bought a nine-year-old sort of juvenile delinquent child that no one else would foster home as company for her son, who was three at the time. And they went on all these mad adventures at five and six. And there was this story about how he'd find this old firecracker, kind of illegal, huge amounts of dynamite inside it, set it off. And as it kind of came down to earth, and he'd kind of strapped a load of little plastic cowboys to it, and as they came back to Earth, it talked about how George, who is the one who is basically the scientist,
he's the lead scientist,
scientist, he watched them come down, but as well as enjoying the sheer kind of boyish glee of watching things burst into flame and explode all around him, his brain was working out the acceleration path, and this child's about five or six at the time, and how it was working and what physics was behind it. And so that I really enjoyed, of sort of understanding his head. I don't know, I just thought it was beautiful.
Whose idea was this?
To develop the...
The Woolly Mammoth Project.
Several people at the same time. And I think it's like, if you look back at all the discoveries through history, so if you look at Bell and Edison and the light bulb, at the same time, loads of people discovered the incandescent light bulb because the science is out there, the enthusiasm is out there, there's a whole buzz around it. And I think that's what happened with this Woolly Mammoth idea. You obviously had Jurassic Park, so the idea got into people's heads. But obviously dinosaurs are roaming the earth hundreds of thousands of years ago. So there is no... What they showed on Jurassic Park is impossible because the DNA wouldn't stay DNA in amber. It would just die off. Whereas woolly mammoths have been found like flash frozen from 3,000 years ago. So their DNA can be taken and you can find out what would create the traits that we associate with a mammoth. You know, red hair, subcutaneous fat, all this sort of stuff. And so they think they can invent one. So you have, I think, did you have South Koreans or... Oh, I'm terrible.
Yes, that's right. There were
South Koreans,
Koreans, yes.
Russians, Americans, everybody's in this sort of woolly mammoth race, which but is just brilliant.
I think what was interesting that I read, too, was that Dr. Church used open sourcing. So any of his knowledge that he would learn as a leading geneticist, he would share with the world. And I think that's usually opposite of what academia do. They like to keep it to themselves so that they can be the ones who are enjoying all the accolades.
And the opposite of the space race as well.
Yes, it's more and more in the case of kind of modern, like if you look at someone like Boston University, I've been reading about recently, and they are dedicated to bringing down the barriers between the different disciplines, between different faculties, and even with other universities, because that's how they feel that science is going to evolve. The decisions that are going to kind of meet all mankind's challenges for the future are going to evolve, because you can no longer have like a biomedical person working without a technician or without a so here you have the geneticists, you have people from different departments, and you had Quinn, who it just seemed to be something to do with tech, and had just watched them do a TEDx talk and wrote in saying, I want to be part of it. And so Church, like you say, is brilliant because he brings everybody with enthusiasm together to make things happen. And great.
What did you enjoy most about the book?
Well, I found it to be a page-turner. I didn't expect it to be a page-turner where we're talking about genetics, because there's a lot of biochemistry involved with it, and I'm not sure that I'm that terribly excited about it. But when you got into the book, it was very exciting, and it's also the personalities of the other doctors and postdoc and pre-doc people who are working on the team. He brought their personalities into it, and I think that made a difference to it too. So it became quite a good page turner for me. And the information, as you said, Rachel, when you looked at it, you'd Google, was this true, did he actually do that, and you'd find it to be accurate on every element.
Yeah, it was outstanding. It really was.
I mean, Ben has actually said in interviews that he's written quite a few nonfiction books. I mean, the book became The Social Network, etc., etc. And this is the one that he said was the most fun to write. It's the one that he's genuinely excited
There's
by.
So much stuff that you weren't even aware was possible. I learned so much reading this book.
And more on the woolly mammoth and what problems, what Pandora's box we are opening, so to speak, when we come back.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. This is David McAdam, the co-host, and today our host is Robin Corton. Sorry, Annabelle Corton.
I'm looking at the name right now.
Robin is great.
Batman psychic. I'll be Batman. You can be Robin.
There you go. And Rachel Hamilton is in here talking about our book of the week, which is called Woolly, which is an incredibly interesting book about genetics and modifying genetics and creating other animals that perhaps could save the planet. But then we also talked about it off air. We were talking about what's going on and are we not, as they say, playing God when we're looking at modifying genetics. What do you think about that, Rachel?
Well, I was saying that I've heard that some people have talked about whether genetical engineering should be termed as a weapon of mass destruction, because recently they've been doing a lot of work with mosquitoes, and apparently there's been research done in Brazil into the Zika virus. And what they've done is they created a load of mosquitoes, a UK company created a load of mosquitoes and released them into a village in Sao Paulo. And this is what Ben Mesrick was saying in his book. And he explained that those mosquitoes had a gene drive that made very competitive males that could only live for 4 days. And so their larvae couldn't survive to become adult proper mosquitoes. And as a result, the genetically altered mosquitoes overwhelmed the local natural population, and the cases of dengue dropped to a tenth of what had previously been reported. So if you're a human, that's fantastic news. If you're a mosquito, not so much. And so the fact that by altering genes, you can wipe out an entire species, theoretically, is quite a frightening thought. And should people have that power? Should we be able to do that to another species, however annoying they are and however much they give us dengue?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Ben Mesrick kind of defends this in this interview that we have with him. And he says that a lot of the complaints haven't actually been about that specifically. It's been about the whole designer baby thing. So having the power to sort of say when you want to have a child, say that it's going to have blue eyes.
Even gender. That worries me.
Exactly. And this is him talking about that.
The genetic engineering involved is the same genetic engineering that's going to be used to make all sorts of things, you know, mosquitoes to beat malaria, reverse aging. You know, they're working on projects to make our kids' generation live 150 years. It's the same technology that allows us to monkey with our own genes.
Right.
So there's, you know, fears of designer babies, of things like that. But the reality is there's so many good things that can come from this. I mean, elephants don't get cancer, which is very strange. Elephants have thousands and thousands of more cells than us. And why they don't get cancer is in their genes. If we can figure that out, you can use this genetic engineering to solve cancer.
On the subject of elephants, just quickly, I've had a lovely text message come in. As I love elephants, it would be lovely to see their long-lost cousins. They'll have a double coat, smaller ears due to the cold, but will look just as majestic.
Nice. Yes.
But onto all the horrible doom and gloom about this.
Well, also, even without the doom and gloom, when you have something that creates an advantage, there's usually some sort of action and reaction. And so let's imagine you can create a world where everyone lives to be 150, nobody dies of dengue, people don't get cancer. You've got a world of so many people that will all be stomping on top of each other. You don't
and
even
overpopulation is already a problem.
Overpopulation is already a problem, and it's going to get worse. And so even if we can make people live longer, should we make people live longer?
That's an even bigger question.
So many big questions in this book. It's fantastic.
Remember, if you'd like to win a copy of Woolly by Ben Mezrich, text in the name of the extinct creature scientists are trying to revive in this book to 4001. And include your name as well so we can shame you if you get the answer wrong.
The other great thing about this as well is it makes science so creative and beautiful and exciting.
Yeah.
And this is, I'm someone who's always preferred art subjects, you know, English and history, even art. And science was always a sort of secondary area. But there's a quote from it, if it's all right to read it, that I loved it.
He
said that a poet sees a flower and can go on and on about how beautiful the colours are. But what the poet doesn't see is the xylem and the phloem and the pollen and the thousands of generations of breeding and the billions of years before that. All of that is only available to the scientist. And I just think that's brilliant because that's the opposite way to what people usually say. You usually say, like William Blake, you know, the poet can see the world in a grain of sand. Whereas what he's saying is actually it's the scientist that sees things in this bigger, more exciting way. Brilliant.
In a way, it's kind of the most creative science book I've ever read.
Yes. And this is the problem. You may have your own moral dilemmas with it. So I'm not a big fan of this full stop. I was saying off air that one of the only companies I refused to work for was a genetic modification company because it bothered me. However, reading this book, I was thinking I'd love to be on his team. I'd love to investigate what's possible. So the theory is absolutely fascinating and incredibly creative.
I mean, like you said, I wasn't sure at the beginning because I thought, hang on a minute, Jurassic Park, they've said that this can't happen, it's impossible, why are they even spending money on something like this if it can't actually happen? But like we've already talked about, it can, and it is necessary. There are benefits to this, because initially I was thinking, well, why do this just for the heck of it? It seems like an awful lot of spending, and not everybody agrees with it, like you were saying. But do you think that it's worth it for what we will gain in terms of the permafrost?
It is difficult.
I think I have a perspective on it. I suggest and put forward that it's not important until it affects you personally, and then suddenly all of the details that you were thinking about maybe are not as relevant as they once were if it's going to make your life better in some way.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's all about how you benefit, isn't it? And our opinions, I think, I always think I'm ignorant about so many things that my opinions are quite fluffy and are able to be changed by a great argument. And so George Church and Ben Mezrich have moved me from quite a staunch, I don't believe in GM food, I don't believe in genetic modification, to thinking, oh, there are many benefits that I hadn't contemplated.
Well, that's the mark of a great book, isn't it?
Yeah.
Broadening your horizons, making
Makes you think. Opens your mind.
Exactly. So I definitely recommend this. And also, it's a short read. We're talking about how much time this is going to take you. It's quite an easy read.
It's an incredibly easy read. When I picked it up and I thought, oh, this is going to take ages. And I couldn't put it down. Literally, you know,
it's
like the best kind of fiction. Yeah, I was read within, I started in the afternoon and I was read by the following morning. Was read. I had read it.
I was
great
read.
Use of English. I was read.
You were
so
orange,
hot.
Technically,
yes,
Oompa Loompa.
I was overheated with excitement. But yeah, no, I thought it was fabulous.
So if we were going to give it a star rating, because we tend to do that on Talking of Books, I mean, what would we give it?
I would give it, what's my top level?
5.
Well, I would actually give it 6. Go all, turn up to 11.
Don't do that.
Because Not only was it brilliant as a book, but it's kept me thinking. I read it last week, and it's kept me thinking all week. It's something that I've discussed with people that I've met. It's something that I've tweeted about. You know, it's something that really gripped me and interested me. So 6 out of 5.
6 out of 5.
I think that's a pretty good score. I found it incredibly interesting to read because it tied nicely with the book that I was talking about earlier called The Physics of the Future, which spoke about genetics and how we're modifying them. And then this book called Woolly by Ben Mesrick basically brought to life the discussions that I was reading in this past book. So I found it interesting on so many levels. I would have to give it a 5++ as well, because I think it's, first of all, I'm not a scientist, and I'm hardly acknowledge that, but that I'm interested in science, and I'm interested in sort of the helicopter view at 5,000 feet of science, not on the petri dish and the pipette and making this all happen. And I found it to be amazingly fast read, interesting, and fun.
Yeah, 5 out of stars for me as well, purely because I can't go over my own limits.
It's very scientific, 6 out of 5.
Yeah,
it is.
Before we finish up on this topic, it does say on the front cover that it's going to be soon to be a major motion picture. I'm really looking forward to that. There's no date that I can find, but it is being produced by the same company that created the Maze Runner franchise, the Twilight series, The Fault in Our Stars, The Longest Ride, and Paper Towns.
This is going to be a teen movie.
a bunch of teen
twinkly Willy mammoths. I like it.
I don't quite know whether that's the movie that they're going for, but we'll see. So thank you very much, Rachel, for telling us all about the Willy mammoth.
Thank you for having me.
More when we come back on Talking of Books.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.